You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. I'm once again joined by Julie. Hey, Julie.
Hello.
And we've got a guest, Dan Thron, friend of the show, who has been on episodes on the first two Dune films, The Exorcist, Steven Soderbergh, and also our 2022 episode on Robert Altman, which one of the films we discussed then was McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which will turn out to be pertinent to this episode. So hello and welcome, Dan. It's great to have you back.
Hello. It's so great to be back. I'm very, very excited about this particular episode. One of my favorite topics.
Very good. This is the second episode in our summer series, The Summer of Genre, where last month we talked about the Benoit Blanc whodunits. And this month we are transitioning to one of the most traditional genres, I would say, in cinema, namely the Western movies. And to begin with, I think I want to just frame a bit where we come from. But let's perhaps start with the definition that the American Film Institute has for the Western. It says that Westerns are a genre of films set in the American West that embodies the spirit, the struggle, and the demise of the new frontier. And we will return to this definition later and also to the tropes and just what makes a Western. But first, how do we get to the Westerns? Are we fans? Did we grow up with Westerns? And since I proposed the topic, I think I will just try to very briefly set the stage with where I'm coming from. As a kid in Europe or in Switzerland, I did, strangely enough, grow up with quite a few Westerns. In the late 70s, early 80s, when I was growing up with only a few handful of TV channels, one of the two German channels would show on a basically daily basis this series called Western von Gestern, which translates roughly into Yesterday's Western. And they always showed that in the late weekday afternoon. So when I came home from school before dinner, I'd switch on the TV and there would either be Knight Rider or the A-Team or Westerns. And by Westerns, I mean, in this case, black and white Westerns. So whatever they could get quite cheaply, I think. It wasn't the famous ones. It wasn't the John Fords. It wasn't the big actors. It was really old stuff from probably just the talkie period, but the early talkie period, but very much B-movie Westerns. I don't remember much in the way of plots because I don't think they showed the plots. They just showed the exciting bits, so to speak. They showed shootouts, duels, sheriffs and outlaws, cowboys and what we would then call Indians. So while I watched these as a kid, I would say watching those first later on gave me almost a bit of a snobbish attitude towards the genre because I saw it as simplistic, generic, kind of childish, you know, white hats versus the black hats and basically the cheapo Westerns. That's what my image was. And that was perhaps reinforced by the cheap German Westerns, you know, the Winnetous of this world that we would get that probably most Americans would laugh at quite deservedly. And also cheap Italian Westerns. I'm not even talking about Sergio Leone. I'm talking about the knockoffs of Sergio Leone. That's what I grew up with. And then also series such as Bonanza. So I did grow up feeling that Westerns were kind of a cheap genre, a predictable genre, a generic genre. And it was only later when I then started watching the Westerns of the 60s and 70s and also seeing the influence of Westerns on so many other genres, directors and films like in Star Wars or in Kurosawa, when I realized that the influence of Westerns is everywhere. And obviously in basically early 2000s, I grew addicted to HBO's Deadwood, which I absolutely love. So I think since then, I have revised my image of what the Westerns are and what they can be. So that was me, perhaps a bit too long. Let's move on to you, Dan. I mean, you're the American here. What is your... Did you grow up with the Westerns?
I think it would be fair to say I came to Westerns a little bit late because I was a Star Wars nerd growing up. So I was, little did I know, I was actually watching Westerns with Star Wars. Like, that's the second generation after Kurosawa, you know, and it is the same Western style plot. So I guess when I caught up with them, that's how I clicked with them. Like, I was like, these are adventure movies, and I like them in this way. But I didn't really get them until, I would say, late in high school and in my early 20s. I started watching like Clint Eastwood movies and lots of like 70s style material because I was watching it off of the movies I was starting to get hooked on, which were all American 70s movies like The Conversation and, you know, everything great you could list from, you know, all the greats of the 70s. And so I actually walked backwards into Westerns via deconstructionist Westerns to start with. I think that's why it's lasted with me for so long as a genre is because, like, my early experience where I'd see one and be like, oh, this is an adventure film. And Clint Eastwood was an adventure film. Like, they're grittier and they're meaner and everything like that. But I was watching it because they're fun. right? That's the start. But you can return to those things. You can return to all of Eastwood's movies like years later and go, actually, these are also kind of deep and they are deconstructionist. And so instead of just returning to them and saying like, oh, yeah, it's kid fun again. Like I was like, oh, it's kid fun, but it's also a real film. Like these are real films. And once I was down that path, it became one of my favorite ways to look at movies. Like it revealed ways to look at movies as a basic toolkit of storytelling that has served me my whole creative life. And also tangentially, when I was about 25, my friend Ben recommended that I read Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, which is one of my favorite novels of all time. And I think that that was when, just as a flavor of storytelling, like it was cemented into my nervous system.
What about you, Julie? Did you grow up with Westerns?
Yeah, I grew up on spaghetti Westerns partly. So Once Upon a Time in the West, that sort of thing. I even wrote about the movie and how it's changed in my perception since I was very young. But I also grew up with Do Not Love, Bud Spencer and Terence Hill. They were supposed to be kid-friendly. I think they were dubbed anyway, but I think I saw some of them in German. So it's kind of a weird entry into the genre. And then it sort of, I revisited classic Westerns when they sort of came back in vogue. That's pretty recently. You know how it goes. You see all the classic, you see the Ford, you see the Stagecoach, you see High Noon, you appreciate them. You learn a little bit about old Hollywood and the way Westerns were treated then, right? Thomas Ince and these really quick, very lucrative, sort of just put some people on horses, film it, you know, get the circus on film while they're in town. That kind of very early Hollywood kind of filmmaking. But I think in terms of the draw of Westerns as a classic genre that came a little bit later, just like Dan just said, in this kind of really roundabout way, you absorb this manner of storytelling, this style of storytelling. And it's a great deal of fun to then go and revisit some of the classics and see how your perception of them has changed over the years.
I think my initial image of the Westerns was really that, probably not that dissimilar from the Wild West shows of, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century, which was very much, you know, these shootouts. You have these very cliched images in your head with the guy hiding behind the saloon sign and kind of shooting at the good guy. And then he's shot, then he falls down with a Wilhelm scream, that kind of thing. You know, the saloon fights where at the beginning, all the furniture is fine. At the end of it, basically, there's just splinters of chairs and broken bottles. There is, I think, this kind of archetypical image of a Western that, at least for me, the way I grew up, I had in my head. Let's perhaps move on to exactly that. What do we think of when we think of the Western? The definition that we had before, it talked about basically the frontier, the spirit, the struggle and the demise of the new frontier. And I think that's very much it. I think more than any other genre, the Western is linked to a place and a time. I think, you know, thrillers or I don't know, whodunit or film noir or even something like, you know, martial arts films, they are not so easily brought back to this one root image of the Western. Whether that is accurate or not is a different question. But there is this image of, you know, Monument Valley, of cowboys and horses and, as I said, Native Americans. That image, I think, is very strong. Is that also the image that you have of the Western or is yours different? Julie, I see you shaking your head, so let's perhaps start with you this time.
I think Westerns, I think it goes for any frontier, right? These are hard men in a hard country, and they are hard times. In that sense, there is perhaps an overlap between modern style Westerns and film noir, even in terms of the cynicism of it. These are nasty times and very bad people live in them. That's what Deadwood did with such humor and such affection, is that there are these awful people living in pretty dire circumstances, right? And they make it so funny. But to me, this goes for any frontier, right? One of the earliest Westerns I've ever seen, and I don't mean early in my life, but the earliest that was made, is actually Australian, right? It's called The History of the Kelly Gang. It's one of the oldest that's still in existence. You can still see it. I recommend you do so. It's an artifact that is really special. It doesn't even have to be the American frontier of before 1900. right? It could be space, the final frontier, but it has to be like an exploration of landscape of time. And it's usually doesn't end well.
This is true.
What about you, Dan? What's kind of your image of the Ur-Western, so to speak, if you have one?
I can't remember who said this, but someone did say this to me, that Westerns are America's Lord of the Rings. Mm. It really stuck with me. And I think it's like at least partially true in that, like, I agree with you that Westerns don't have to happen in America to be Westerns. What's most important about Westerns is that this time period did not exist. This is pure myth. And like, there are plenty of good movies set in America and not, but set in America, say in the 1830s and the 1840s, that are period piece movies that show a much more realistic view of what it was like. And it is not like a Western. Like, this is nothing that you see in any of these things has anything to do really with reality. It uses the iconography, like the physical iconography of frontier life, to wrestle with questions of identity, both on sort of a national scale and on a personal scale. And I think that why the Western sort of exports so well is that even though it's always thought of, when you just sort of bring it up, you think about all the American Westerns, but the actual struggles that it tries to talk about are much grander than any single country. And they really have to do with who we feel as, say, a people versus as a person. And the history of what has happened before me and my responsibility or lack thereof to that history, or the people who were here before me and where I stand vis-a-vis that. Like, the frontier that's being talked about is always a frontier of self versus the outward world. And I think that that is like all of the great Westerns essentially tackle that head on, and they make it. Like, the reason why it's a, like, there are plenty of Western novels, like I said, really one of the great novels of all time, Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, but Westerns work particularly well in film because of the immediacy of film makes you think in very personal, immediate terms of experience of the person that you are literally watching do things, but they are in the context of something that is always mythical and greater and slightly cartoonized to an extent. So you can talk about the greater meanings of these things. Like, it works both unconsciously in all the old school Westerns, like you were bringing up before, like the cheapies that got pumped out, where it's like, good guy, black hats, white hats, you know, like that works really well because there's an innate sense of what is right and wrong in everyone. And it's easy to deliver that when you're working in cartoon strokes. And it also works in a very gray landscape of deconstructionism, because of the immediate reality of what you are literally watching, which is something that not even novels can do. Like, film makes you very, very present in the frame. And so Westerns have aged. I think that Westerns not only are interesting in their construction to begin with, but they become more and more useful tools the longer they're around, because now it's almost impossible to use these tools without automatically thinking about both the macro and the micro of what you're doing symbolically.
And it's always interesting that there are, of course, novels of Western novels, but there are also some very good nonfiction books that actually describe the period that we're talking about and sometimes the people. There was a good book about Jesse James and the myth of Jesse James and whether he was even trying to create his own myth and in what way and so on and so forth. So they're really good, but they do not sound in any way like the West that we know from the fictional Westerns, right? We're going to get into Wyatt Earp a little bit later, but this is high on symbolism. This is also high on concepts like justice. Are you justified because you're a righteous man, or are you justified because your actions are just, you know, all that sort of really high philosophical process of thought are inserted in this very sort of action-packed, accessible, very cinematic genre, especially as a genius like John Ford makes every frame just a painting you can hang on your wall. It is so incredible. Compelling. And that none of it is true doesn't really matter, because these are the stories about the creation of a nation or the creation of a person or the creation, as you say very rightly, of an identity as a culture, the encroachment of civilization upon uncivilized whoever cattle ranchers, or the mythical town of Deadwood, which existed but not in that way. And the law inserting itself into a community that has no idea what to do with it, again, goes back to Wyatt Earp and who he actually was, but also towards his myth, and so on and so forth. We see these types of stories in these Reagan-era Dirty Harry type films, right? The vigilantism, the sense of your own justice, the all of that is sort of very profound to who we think we are, what we think ourselves to be as a culture and as people. Yeah, I think that's quite true.
And if I can build on that for a second, like I think that there's, you touched on something that I think is also totally integral to the experience, is that Westerns are so much fun. Like they're such movies. It's hard to make them not fun. Like, yeah, we're going to talk about The Assassination of Jesse James with Coward Robert Ford, which is a wonderful work of art, and it's still fun. Like, you're still like, this is still a fun movie. And like, I think that there is an art versus commerce aspect to this that works on that same weird frontier. Like when you framed it, it's like, this is about the frontier. It is about the frontier. Like, it is about frontiers. It's about that space. Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
Let's perhaps start making this more concrete and start with the first of our three films, which is Julie's film. Which film have you brought along, and perhaps also why?
It's called My Darling Clementine, and you can easily count it as one of the classic Westerns. It has Henry Fonda. It was directed by John Ford, who is one of the greatest and gave his name to the Western as a genre. I mean, it was just brilliant stuff. And it's also interesting because it's about Wyatt Earp. And it ends with the gunfight at the OK Corral, which did not, in fact, happen at the OK Corral and wasn't called the gunfight at the OK Corral until after a film came out that was called Gunfight at the OK Corral. The historical Wyatt Earp was a sheriff who got embroiled in a personal vendetta with a clan that ended up in court. There are historical records. There are also biographies about Wyatt Earp. Pretty much contemporary, but this movie is not interested in any of that. They don't care. We have Henry Fonda being fabulous, his brother, who is obviously a gentler type, which, you know, just about that's your fate sealed for you if you're a gentler type and you're in the West, gets murdered. The cattle gets stolen, and Henry Fonda becomes sheriff and in the end decides to round up a posse of his brothers and Doc Holliday and goes on his mission of revenge, sort of, kind of, because he's obviously the righteous man because it's Henry Fonda, come on. And it's an interesting film, I think, because it has so many of the tropes that we associate with the genre. It has this theme of civilization inserting itself. One of the lovely scenes at the very beginning is Henry Fonda wants a shave. So he goes into a barber to get a shave. The barber wants to do perfume. Just a shave, he says. And before he's even lathered up properly, the shooting starts, right? That's the scene in this film. It's lovely. It's really well done. The film is also...
I love the barber saying, we also offer baths.
Exactly, yeah. And the running gag in the film, you reminded me of it, Dan, that women keep talking to him about the scent of the honeysuckle and the scent of the desert blooms, and he just keeps saying, that's me, because the barber has tried some new cologne on him. Yeah, it's absolutely lovely. It's really well done. There's a dance. There are all sorts of, there's a church being built, or at least a church bell being built. So all these encroaching civilization upon barbary of the West. Also these theme of a sheriff and what justice is in such a community. And also a fair bit of how your past can haunt you in the theme around Doc Holliday, which is something that Clint Eastwood ran away with much, much later and to great effect in Unforgiven. But this is a pretty early one, and I thought it was interesting because it's A, very mainstream, B, very much within the type of story. It's actual Wyatt Earp and the gunfight at the OK Corral, so very sort of loyal to its storytelling. And it's John Ford, and we can't skip John Ford when we're talking about Westerns. I think that's a misdemeanor somewhere. And also, it's one of those films I really, really do recommend everyone to see it. It's just beautifully done. It's a lot of fun. There's some action-packed scenes. There's a lot of drama because there are two women and both of them love Doc Holliday and all that sort of very classic Hollywood stuff. And Fonda is extraordinarily good in it as well. I mean, he plays this like almost like he's a teenager physically, with this really gangly way he goes about the dance and his flirtations. And it's a very, very nice performance as well. So this is one of those that I can also, from the heart, really recommend to somebody going in for one of the classic Westerns. But watch all of them. Watch Stagecoach as well. But, you know, it's one of the, I think it's just a lovely thing.
It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned in this film that, you know, Wyatt Earp's brother, the kid who's killed, that he's a gentler one. But what I find interesting is that Henry Fonda's character, he's not a rugged, rough, you know, he's not the John Wayne character. He's strangely passive for a fairly long time. I mean, you mentioned the kind of revenge story, and obviously it kind of ends up as justice and revenge basically being the same almost. You know, they go and get the bad guys and someone gets basically killed tragically, sacrifices himself heroically. But for the longest time, it's basically Henry Fonda's character, Wyatt Earp, he's one of those iconic heroes, superheroes almost of the Wild West. And for the longest time, he becomes the sheriff. And then he sits on his porch and waits for something else to happen. And he waits and he waits and he waits. It takes a long time for the film to get into some of the Western cliches. So I do agree, it is very much classic Western in its iconography. But it also undermines the cliches already. And I think probably a lot of the classics that we associate with the stereotype of the Western are possibly already more subversive than we give them credit for.
Mm-hmm. I agree, much agree with this.
Yeah, there's a great deal of subversion also in terms of that initially, justice is not necessarily done by direct violence, right? There is a standoff between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, which is all about a gun and whether it's loaded or not loaded. I'm not sure whether another star was considered for this part, but it wouldn't surprise me because he's a very surprising presence in this film. But a lot of it is about being a lawman, and that sometimes people write because an actor won't show up on stage. And how do you deal with that, right? Or people just get drunk and rowdy. And that's a lot of the film as well. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm so glad you recommended this one, because when it was initially brought up, I was like, oh yeah, that's a really great movie. And what I was thinking of was Tie a Yellow Ribbon.
Oh yeah.
Which is also a good fun movie. But when I started watching this, I was like, wait, Henry Fonda? And I was like, have I even seen this? Like, if I have seen this, it was so long ago. I can barely, I mean, like, there's images from the movie that I recall. So I must have seen it like a while ago. But for me, it was virtually a brand new watch. Like, it was really actually thrilling. And I love John Ford. But he made like 130 movies or something like that. So it's impossible to keep up with them. And I love Henry Fonda. And man, I'll try to keep this short. I have a few bits on this movie. So I thought it was terrific. Thoroughly loved it. I love John Ford films anyway, and I think that John Ford doesn't get enough credit for creating the kind of filmmaking that we basically use today. Like, he made so many films, and he was such a journeyman that, like, the things that he, you know, invented and then polished, and then the rest of us picked up as just natural language of film, it's just sort of shocking that you go, oh, but that may have been the first time that this gag was used, or this shot was used, or whatever it is. And of course, if you're a Steven Spielberg fan, it's like every 20 seconds you see a shot that Spielberg's like, yeah, like, oh, I'm going to do that one, you know. But this movie also gives me a chance to talk about another one of my favorite Westerns on the side. And because when you're putting this together, we're talking about whether or not we're going to have modern Westerns and what those are. And we'll talk about one of them later. But a modern Western that I have gargantuan a love for, and I've seen a shocking number of times, is Michael Mann's 2006 Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Which is an absolute masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. And I've been obsessed with it for years and years, including I went to the Egyptian Theater out here a couple of years ago with my son, who knows how much I love. I went with my daughter, Sam. And I went with my son to see Tenet. That's a whole other podcast. I went with my daughter to see Miami Vice. And when I got there, I thought it was going to be fun. Like, the Egyptian's a great theater. It's great old classic theater. This is going to be wonderful. But I was expecting, like, you know, a few people to show up. It's not like this is his big hit film, you know. It was packed. The entire theater, every seat sold out. And seeing Miami Vice with people that are Miami Vice obsessives is like going to U2 at the height of their popularity. It was just insane. Plus, at the end of that movie, the announcer came in and is like, oh, and just don't stick around for a second. We have a special guest. And Michael Mann to talk about Miami Vice.
Wow.
So that's my very quick Miami Vice setup. But Miami Vice as a movie is structurally really mesmerizing to me because it is definitely a Western, but it is a structure that I saw mirrored in My Darling Clementine. And I know that Michael Mann is a giant fan of John Ford. So when I saw this, I was like, oh, this is where he got this gag. This is it. Which is that you have two characters, that two male leads, that each represents a different aspect of masculinity. And they are clearly in love with one another. Like, this is a love story between these two men. And there is, in both films, proxy women that they can be in love with, so we can have this dialogue in a regular popular American film and nobody gets uncomfortable.
It's all very Red River, yeah.
Exactly. So in My Darling Clementine, I thought this was really stunning because it's a classic Western, like we're talking about, with frontiers and shifts between what was old and what is new. It embodies the concept with two characters, with Fonda and with Doc Holliday. Doc Holliday is the old West. He's the gunfighter. You know, he's the bad man. You know, like, you like him, but he's a bad man. He's a dangerous man. And his way of life is dying, and he is dying. He is dying of tuberculosis, literally. But he is slowly going away. Henry Fonda has been out on the range and, you know, tending to cattle, but he has come into town to settle down and become sheriff and support the new thing that has happened, which is the burgeoning society that is being built on the American plains. So these two things are the frontier we're talking about. And it's the difference between these two guys that puts them at odds through almost the entire film. They believe that they are opposed when actually they are unified, which is a statement about America to start with, which is just genius. The beautiful, like, Clementine herself represents, like, this is the grown-up, real, long-term love affair, marriage kind of personality that you want. You want it for Henry Fonda. And Henry Fonda also wants this. Like, Henry Fonda falls in love with Clementine and tries to get Doc Holliday to get together with Clementine so he can at least by proxy know somebody who has gotten together with her. Like, that's how much of a crush he has on her just from the moment he sees her. But Doc Holliday is resistant to this because Doc Holliday is the old West. He's like, I am too dangerous for the likes of you. Like, you are the brand new person of this world.
And also doomed, you know, there is this very deep sense that he's done for.
His way of life is done for. He's physically done for. Like, why would you marry me? I'm dead. Like, I'm already dead. And I've been trying to save you from that grief. And meanwhile, Chihuahua, the woman who is in love with Doc Holliday and is actively going after him the whole time, she is representative. She's of his world. Like, she is lusty and immediate and aggressive. And, like, they're very much emotionally paired up. She also dies. Like, they go away together. And the beauty, so the thing that sealed the deal on this movie for me, like, and that I knew that John Ford was aware of what he was doing structurally, comes down to two sequences that just knocked me out and, like were breathtaking as soon as I realized it both times. Henry Fonda is worried for Clementine. Dangerous things are happening, obviously, but she's going to go to the dance that's happening for the building of the church. And he's like, I'll walk you over there. I got choked up just watching this. It blew my mind.
It's a great scene.
He takes her by the arm and walks with her, and they stop talking and they just keep walking, and the camera tracks backwards with them. And in the background, you can hear where they're going. You hear the music that the church folks are singing, which is, yes, we'll gather at the river, right? And just in that moment, you're like, we are walking down the aisle
right.
with them.
Exactly.
Like, they're headed towards a church. Like, and this is them. This is their marriage scene in a totally empty town. And the only thing that's happening is it is framed like where he is using the technique of film to say, this is how we would shoot a marriage scene. Like, this is when you walk down the aisle and the music is playing. I was overwhelmed. Like, this is the future. And then there's an actual dance at an actual church that's being constructed. The other side of it, on the Doc Holliday side. Okay. So we've had the marriage. Doc Holliday and Fonda have been sort of like, they've been at odds. Fonda comes to think that Holliday killed Fonda's brother. and everything's going to go wrong. He's going to arrest him, and that's that. And it all hinges on Chihuahua, which is the woman who wants to be Doc Holliday's Belle. And they are talking to her, like, what is the truth here? Who gave you this thing, right? They're like, who gave you this necklace? Because that necklace is my brother's. And if he gave it to you, then I know that Doc Holliday killed my brother and I'll send him to jail. And she's like, she finally gives in and says, no, it was...
Billy Clegg, I think, yeah.
Right, it was the bad guys. The moment she says it, she's shot by the bad guys. And that's when these two guys are like, no, we are now on the same side. Like, it's been cleared up, but now she's in danger. She's, like, been shot. She's dying. If only we had a doctor, right? Doc Holliday's like, oh, I can't do it. I'm not really a doctor. Not anymore. But he gets one more shot to be who he was and save her, right? They clear out the bar. They turn the bar into an OR. And she's lying there under the lamp. Soft light, like it's lit like Captain Kirk in love with an alien. Like it's just like
it's lit like a melodrama, right?
It's lit like a melodrama. Soft, beautiful light. Her eyes are half open and he's leaning over. Everyone else is silhouetted, so they may as well just be alone together. It's a super quiet scene, and he is leaning over and gently saying to her, like, listen, we have no way to knock you out. This is gonna hurt like hell. So if you need to scream, scream. And she's like, cool. And he starts to work. And it cuts to a wide of the town, and you expect to hear the scream. No scream, which is beautiful. Cuts back in, and then it's him looking over, and he says, I hope that didn't hurt too bad. And it cuts to her, and she looks like she's had the best sex of her life.
She glows.
This is the sex scene between them. This whole surgery business was just to make this as intimate as we can possibly have it be.
Without getting censored, yeah.
Without getting censored, right? And so we have had the marriage scene, which is the we are committing to eternal love together, and which is the heart and the mind unified, looking forward into the future. And then we have the sex scene, which is passionate and immediate, and shortly thereafter ends in death, you know, but it's living life immediately. And those two scenes represent those two characters coming together into a unified force that is what America is about. Like, this is the history that we are letting into the past, and this is who we are becoming. And in doing so, pairing up, we are empowered to kill the people who would take down that ideal. Like, that is so flawlessly executed. I was just like, this is what you get from a journeyman director like Ford. He's just like, I'm not even going to have anybody say that. Like, it's just gonna be that way. You'll get it or you won't get it.
It's interesting because the Chihuahua operating scene does not turn out to be Doc Holliday's redemption, right?
Yes, yeah, right.
Significantly, he is not redeemed by that. He doesn't find his quote-unquote old self back or his dignity or any of that.
Right.
His redemption, in the end, is... well, what else could it be? An act of self-sacrifice to enable the new and civilized.
Absolutely.
To prevail over the old and corrupt. So it's all there.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. He gets to have this last romantic, passionate moment. And after that, he's like, well, I guess I'm out.
I mean, I totally agree with that. I also do think there's a flip side to this. I mean, yes, I totally agree. I mean, obviously, Doc Holliday stands for the old West, for the kind of, for a West that has to end and die. But at the same time, I think, you know, there's also, as you said, I think, Julie, there's not just a teenage quality to Von White, there's almost a childlike quality, childlike innocence to him and Clementine. Whereas Doc Holliday, he's the anti-hero, and Chihuahua, she's the sexy one. So to some extent, I think there's something much more attractive also to teenagers, not to children, but to teenagers, about exactly Doc Holliday and Chihuahua. And I think the him having to die fits in with that. You know, it is the kind of archetype that is very much modern as well as old and perhaps, you know, past its prime. This live fast, die young. I mean, okay, he didn't live that fast, but still he's the one who has to die before his time because he couldn't go and marry and be a pillar of society. And exactly this individual who can die, the romanticism, the eroticism of death is totally something that it doesn't die with the Doc Holliday's. It lives on. And I think that's something we will have in both of the other films.
Yes, it is folded into Fonda's life. This is the brilliance of it, is because it really is a movie about Henry Fonda. I mean, if Henry Fonda were simply hopefulness and goodness, that is a shallow character. There's nothing to it. Doc Holliday is his id. But he's also gritty reality. Gritty reality, good. Gritty reality, bad. But gritty reality. Like, here's the real stuff. And that gets folded up in all the, I must be a good person, we have to abide by the law and all this stuff. All of that, if it remained up in the sky, it would be meaningless. But it brings it back down to the earth to have Doc Holliday's story and his Twisted Together Forever. That unity is what makes it work.
Yeah, and he puts his badge away, literally puts his badge away and goes out and is just not the sheriff anymore for the last bit of his journey. I mean, in a certain sense, that sort of does give a wink to what actually happened, which is that Wyatt Earp did, in fact, try to fight out this vendetta as a sort of act of vigilantism. But this is highly symbolic. He says, this is a family matter. That's his quote. He puts his badge away. He says, this is family affair. I think if you ask me, okay, give me something that is A, brilliant, but B, also very stereotypical Western, but also kind of groundbreaking, this is what I would come up with.
Yeah, it's like, and I think, because I was talking about it with my wife, like, I was just like, I think people imagine older movies like this as being unsubtle and unable to understand the complexities of what they're putting on screen. And sometimes that's true, but it's always true. John Ford was a smart guy. Henry Fonda is a very smart guy. Like, these guys know how to tell stories. And if Dostoevsky can write Crime and Punishment 100 years previous to this, they can also have deep thoughts while they're making their movie in the 1950s. You know, like, that's how it works. And I feel like there's always, this is true in any, like, John Ford was impervious to talking about any of this kind of baloney. Like, he would be embarrassed by what we are saying here. He'd be like, shut up, you know, like, as he did to, like, Peter Bogdanovich trying to interview him. He's just like, so what does this mean when you're blah, blah, blah? He's talking about all the symbolism. John Ford's like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, it's very hard to find, but there's a, it might be on YouTube. There is this film called Directed by John Ford, which is absolutely brilliant in that way. And it gives you an immediate idea of the kind of thing we're talking about. Yeah.
It's one of these things where I can't believe Ford wasn't aware. I mean, he executes it so well that I don't think he is doing this unconsciously. And the same thing I feel about something as complex as The Searchers, for instance, like, there's no way that that is done unconsciously. This is a very, very subtle conscious choice that he is making. But with this, the elegance of this stuff shouldn't surprise people because there were grown-ups making the film. But it does talk about one thing. Actually, two things I want to bring up. One is that this is definitely... What year did this come out? This was 1946.
Very early, yeah.
This is a post-war struggle film if I've ever seen one. Holy smokes. Like, this is... I have done terrible things over in the war. That's my Doc Holliday half. And now I have to come back to society. This is the Henry Fonda half. And this is one of my favorite things about 40s and 50s and into the 60s, Westerns and up to and including like Star Trek, where you see these stories still being wrestled with by their writers as late as like when Star Trek premiered with the one called The Menagerie, I think is the one where it's like the original Star Trek cast with a different captain and all that stuff. Like, that is, it is a Western and it is about dealing with post-war scars. And so once you start looking at all of these movies in that context, like, stop thinking of them as the Old West, but start thinking about the time they came out. They are speaking to what is happening for people in that very day.
Right. And in the 50s, just a reminder for context, in the 50s, the way the culture was then, that was probably one of the ways you could put a story like that on screen without being muzzled, right? So you make it a Western, you make it whatever, but you can't put it on screen the way it was.
Yeah, this is the way, like, Scorsese talks about that as like being a smuggler.
Right, exactly.
Like, you know, just like you're making an entertaining bit of work so you can carry a message inside it and nobody notices until later, or they feel it and they internalize it without intellectualizing it. Luckily, you have podcasters like us to intellectualize things. But like when you're watching the movie, it's right down in here. And I think that that's the, to bring it back up to what Westerns are in that context. Like, I feel like Westerns are the epitome of using entertainment to talk about things that are not things you want to talk about or not things you want to confront. And so they're some of the most successful films at being true artistic tools for self-examination while never leaving the movieplex. Give me what I am paid for. This is a get out the popcorn experience that you want them to be.
And it's also in a way plausible deniability, especially in the 50s. With Westerns, you see that less so, but also in terms of the culture after, of course, the 1918 pandemic, then the 30s, the financial crisis, then you get Roosevelt, then you get the New Deal, you get these sort of counter movements, and there were several. And you have the kind, in the Western, you have the kind of plausible deniability of what we could now call the left and the right.
Yes, right.
You can both see this as, look, this is talking to me.
Because we actually believe mostly the same stuff. Like, this is, I think this is so core. Like, I obsess about Westerns in particular because, like, anyone can tell I'm a crazy leftist. It's true, right?
We're European, Dan. I think.
An honorary European, exactly.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But, like, I've had the pleasure of, like, I've gone on road trips across America with my son and north and south all over the place. And everyone we meet and everywhere we've gone is wonderful. Like, politics completely aside, I feel like we live amongst a bunch of well-meaning good folks. And I really feel solid about that. Now, and I think that we have been convinced by external powers to believe that we are at odds and it's tearing us apart is very much my darling Clementine.
Because you're circling each other. And you're actually two sides of the same coin while you're circling each other. You just haven't noticed it yet. It's the same thing over and over. So I think it's interesting. I think it's also interesting if you were to make it Clementine now. So you would use, say, the Wyatt Earp mythos to tell a story now. You would come up with something completely different. Because, as you say, in the context, we are not living after a world war in which we were only dragged kicking and screaming at the very end when we could no longer deny what was happening, right? But still, I think some of the themes are current with My Darling Clementine, even if if you see, you can hardly believe it was that early.
Yeah,
it's that early.
It's stunning. I think you really hit it because, like, it's a perfect example of, like, the way that I receive it today might be different in one way than it was received when it came out. Like, because, like, when it came out, I'm sure that it was more affecting to people in terms of the post-war context, which means it was very personal. Like, I can imagine watching this and saying, I am both of these men. Like, this is a conflict within myself. This is the internal conflict made external. And whereas, like, Dan Thron today watches this and sees what you just brought up, Julie, which is, like, this is the left and the right of the country that are seemingly at odds when there's no reason for it to be it. Like, we are only put at odds by a lying external force that is manipulating us. And so, like, the internal and the external is that frontier that Westerns can cross over so fluidly. And that's why they are so good at connecting the interiority of powerful emotion to the external, like, huge forces that shape our lives as a country and as a world. Like, it matches these things in a one-to-one way, which I also talked about, I probably said it before, which is just proper melodrama. Like, that's what melodrama is. Like, you'll be like, when you watch something like, whatever, Titanic, the reason why you tell this love story on the Titanic is because if you were to physicalize the scale of the love within your heart when you feel that in love, it's that big. Like, you need to make it that big in the movie screen.
You need Joan Crawford, at least, right?
You need Joan Crawford. Like, you're not there to, like, do, like, a very intimate, small, realistic love story that can also be very true. But if you're going to sell tickets and really feel it, you tell this story. Like, movies can make things bigger than big. And that's how you feel on the inside. This is what Westerns do almost naturally.
I think taking that bigger than big is perhaps that's a good point to transition to the second film that we have. And we're jumping quite a lot of years. I mean, you mentioned Star Trek, but we're going way further into the future. And I have to say, first, when I thought about which film I'd like to bring to the table, I first thought Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, mainly because I just love that film to bits. But the film I went for in the end, I think in some ways, because I just recently rewatched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, in some ways the film I'm bringing is almost like the dark shadow reflection of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and it's The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford from 2007, a film made by not an American filmmaker, but an Australian, Andrew Dominik. fantastic, wonderful cinematography by Roger Deakins, music by Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. And I think the music is almost a character in this film. And it stars Brad Pitt as Jesse James, Casey Affleck as Robert Ford, but also it's got a fantastic supporting cast, Sam Rockwell as Robert Ford's brother Charlie, Sam Shepard as Frank James, the older brother of Jesse James. And I think what we have here is very much about the Western icons as celebrities. That's also why you've got Brad Pitt playing Jesse James. It has to be someone who's basically recognizable. It has to be someone that people swoon for, that people would, you know, hang up posters in their room. And that's very much the kind of Jesse James we have here. He is an icon. He is a celebrity. Even though he's a bad guy, he's someone who basically is a career criminal. He's a Confederate sympathizer after the Civil War, but he is an icon. And the thing is also, that's also how Robert Ford comes to him. Bob Ford is basically, he's a fanboy. And the fanboy who wants to be Jesse James, perhaps even wants to have Jesse James, there's something not too dissimilar from Patricia Highsmith's Talented Mr. Ripley here. And when he can't be Jesse James, when he can't have Jesse James, the next best option is, of course, to kill Jesse James. So I think that's the kind of story we have here. And I think we have a similar dyad in that respect, but they're more antagonistic, of course. The iconic star, who's also a monster to some extent, but he is a star. And the monster is also a good husband and a good father. And then you've got this sniveling, weaselly Bob Ford, but he's also, he's relatable because he's a normal human being. He's not Brad Pitt. So to some extent, there's something relatable to Bob Ford, even when we dislike his kind of creepy side. So I know, Dan, you're also a big fan of this film.
This is one of the greatest movies I've ever made. This is just one of the greatest movies I've ever seen in my life. And I can't believe that it's not talked about in the same breath with The Godfather. And it's just, every time I see it, I come into it going like, is it really as good as I remember? And then I'm like, it's better than I remembered. There's almost nothing like this movie. And I think that I'm in the bag for Andrew Dominik. I think that Dominik is one of the most, he's got to be the most talented unknown artist in the world.
And just to interrupt you, but Jesse James has this sense of serendipity in the way that it brings material and filmmaker together to create this sort of chemistry. I think this is probably his best one as well.
Oh, it's astonishing. I do think it's his best film, though. I mean, it's sort of splitting hairs with a couple of them, but like, I do think it's his best film. I think that like Brad Pitt has been a longtime supporter of Dominik's, and I think he's produced virtually like at least his last, you know, three films. And I will, let's see, I will very delicately recommend an incredible movie that is of the hardest films I've ever watched to experience. Watch his movie Blonde for Netflix. It is one of the ugliest, nastiest films I've ever seen, like ever. It's upsetting in such profound and personal ways. It's hard to come away from the movie not angry, but it is a perfect counterpoint to Jesse James and talks about the same thing. And the movie itself made me think harder about what Jesse James means. So I strongly, strongly recommend that, because I think in both cases, Dominik is talking about, in Jesse James, he is talking about today in very, very specific terms about what has gone wrong for us. And to touch one last time on Blonde, if you do watch Blonde, I warned you, but go into it knowing that this is not a movie about Marilyn Monroe. It is a movie about how we destroy ourselves by smothering ourselves beneath an image that we project of ourselves all the time. Like the internal is absolutely killed by the external projection of self that we are constantly forced to employ.
Full disclosure, we disagree on Blonde.
Of course, yeah. I think we've actually talked about this one at a time, but yeah.
We've talked about this, and I think this works for Jesse James for me, right? This is always personal. In a way that it doesn't work with Monroe, because I just know too much about Monroe. And if you look at Jesse James was so much of a myth even during his life. And he created an atmosphere around himself as well, though to what extent is hard now to judge. But especially the outside, and it's so long ago, it's easier to see for the projection that it is. And if we talk about humans that we feel something for, Jesse James is hard to sympathize with. The historical Jesse James is hard to sympathize with. He was a Confederate. He was an exceptionally violent man. He was a horrifying racist. He was a lot of things that are don't make it. He's hard to sympathize with. Monroe, not so hard.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Which is what makes the movie so unpleasant. We won't spend too much time on it, but like, I think you and I totally agree on that movie in that, like, I think that it is, I think your criticisms are exactly correct, and that it is, it's harsh because it believes in what it's saying so much, but it's also so harsh that it gets in its own way for 99% of the experience.
Which is not the case with Jesse James.
It is a great way into Jesse James. And I feel like that Jesse James is best looked at as, even for Dominic to see as early as 2007, how we culturally in the world were splitting in ourselves, our public and private selves, were becoming two entirely different and opposed identities within each of us. And to make a movie about that concept is beyond me. Like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
It's so interesting because we touched on this with Clementine, right? Again, it's the Western that gives us the roadmap to that journey that is so much of the interior of people, right? Also, everybody's amazing in this. Rockwell is just, what is the guy's name? He's also in No Country for Old Men. And I think he was born with a Stetson on his head.
Garrett Dillahunt.
Oh, God, he's brilliant in it.
Love Garrett Dillahunt.
Absolutely shockingly, stunningly wonderful in it. I mean, how is everybody even so good in this for 3 hours?
And they all capture an aspect of loneliness that is different from all of the others, you know, and everyone in this movie is lonely. Like, they're just crushingly, crushingly lonely. And when Pitt is talking to Garrett Dillahunt, and like the subtext of the entire scene is like, I think you told the authorities about me and I'm going to kill you, is essentially what Brad Pitt is saying. And Garrett Dillahunt's trying to lie his way out of it. Garrett Dillahunt's too dumb and scared to do that. Like, Jesse is very smart. Jesse knows what's going on. And he knows that the only thing he can be sure of is Jesse knows he's lying. And so you're just watching the scene where these guys are getting further and further and further apart. And it looks like Dillahunt is dying in the scene. Like, he's getting paler and paler and he's starting to like cry. He's still acting like everything's fine.
It's a shockingly good performance.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I don't know where Dominic came from to pull this kind of stuff off of these guys, but it's just outrageous.
Yeah, absolutely. And Pitt, it's interesting because it goes to the theme of the film. It's not any sort of shade on Pitt, but Pitt doesn't really need to do anything. He needs to be there and be an incredibly famous person.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, I think Pitt is an underrated movie star.
Oh, he's very good. Yeah, he's very good.
Like, he knows exactly the tools and boundaries of his personality, and he knows what he can leverage and what he can play off of, and his own image outside the film and all this. He's extremely aware of all this stuff. And he takes little beats to allow more room for the other actor. Like, he barely, like you're saying, he barely does any acting. He just sits there and gives the other actor room over and over and over again and lets things play out like this.
Totally. While also at the same time kind of suffocating them because he is Brad Pitt, just his presence.
I mean, he's like, huge. Yes.
Exactly. You know, you can't get out of the gravity well of Brad Pitt. In some ways, you know, he's the dark version of the Brad Pitt character in the Ocean's 11 movies. Exactly. Where he's also just, he's Brad Pitt. He's a star. And that's the thing. I mean, you understand that you can't live just next door to a star. The gravity is just too strong. It's going to crush you.
It's a beautiful thing to say because like imagine if we're all just sitting here right now and Brad Pitt came in and sat down and said, don't mind me. Like, the only thing any of us could think about would be Brad Pitt is here. That is Brad Pitt. And then our brains would be screaming it at the top of our brain lungs in order to like get our attention to look over it. Don't look, don't look, don't look. And to be Brad Pitt in that scene where you walked into a room and you destroyed everything that was happening. Now, you didn't mean to at all. You just did. There is no place where you can be together with anyone. Like, it ruins everything you touch.
Yeah, exactly. What this reminded me of in my last rewatch, it's particularly for this podcast, was Power of the Dog. The man exudes I don't want to call it evil, but he is a good enough actor that he sweats death. And he's a beautiful man to look at, right? this could easily have gone wrong because everybody's too handsome in this anyway. But he manages in this sort of very enclosed performance that he gives to exude poison. And he keeps saying, I don't mean to be poisonous, right? But it's the frog and the scorpion, and he is the scorpion. And when he stings you, the only thing he can say is, you knew I was a scorpion. He does that very well. I think it's a very good performance. I don't mean to say he does, he's like a brick. It's a very good performance, but it's very contained.
Yeah, well, I think that's the, like, the, I always say with, like, the difference between actors and movies, because people will be like, well, you know, he just always plays the same thing. I'm like, yeah, but nobody else plays Brad Pitt. It's an extremely unique skill. And to be so aware of what your abilities are and how you can, and, like, where movie stars go wrong, and this happens with even some of the greats, you know, like Liz Taylor and whatever, but it's just like, movie stars go wrong when they want a movie to be about them, when they do, and they force a movie to be about them. The movie's going to be about them anyway, because they're the star. Like, just them being present changes the chemistry of everything that you're seeing. Brad Pitt understands that 100%. He does not try to self-consciously drag your attention away from anyone. Like, you know he's in the room, even if you saw him in a reflection in the window, you know he's present, and you can feel it in the other actors. And that is what describes the grandness of Jesse James as a personality, is that Jesse is present when Jesse isn't present. Like, it's the only thing that can be thought about in the movie. It's the only topic of conversation for any one of these characters, is what would Jesse think? What would Jesse do? What should we do about Jesse? When is Jesse coming? And it looms like death for everyone. And so when you say, like, that he exudes death, like, in the scene with Pitt, he's so fidgety, and, like, you can feel like he might just shoot Bob. Like, this conversation just might be over with a gunshot, and you can feel it. Like, they're at the table and he's like, no, go ahead, you tell the story. Giant pause. You know, and you're like, oh God, I want to die. The movie makes us into both. It creates such a space of empathy for both Jesse James and Robert Ford, because you see Jesse James as an icon of aspiring, this is who I wish I were, until you come to know him. And it's the tragedy of, that's who you are. Like, these are the same character. It just inverts into a different person. And when you see, Robert Ford at the bar at the end in his place, and this random guy is going to come in and kill him, as he's turning and it just freeze frames it, like, the look in his eyes is like, well, here it is. Like, this is it.
He's already dead at that point, I think. Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things. I love the title, because the title is a gigantic lie. I don't think Bob Ford at the end is a coward, and I don't think it's an assassination. What we're watching is a weird roundabout suicide. You know, Jesse James can't die, so he has to be killed somehow. Bob Ford is the one who will do it, but that scene, I mean, he presents his back. Jesse James presents his back to Bob Ford. He wills him to kill him. And I think in that scene, I almost get the impression Jesse wants to be killed by Bob more than Bob wants to kill Jesse.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Like, this is, like, the movie should be called The Assassination of Ourselves by Us. This is a movie about being uncomfortable with who we present ourselves to be, and uncomfortable with who we are when we're alone.
And what we're made to be as well.
Like, that is the beauty of the thing. That's what makes it so, so sad. And it just gets sadder and scarier every time I watch it, because it's more and more visibly true in every conversation I have with virtually anyone online about anything. I saw a YouTuber I watched that brought this up and just said, I think that we have two separate cultures now, only we are a part of both. There's the online version of us, and then there's the private version of us. And these two personalities are often at odds now. Like, when we're online, we have extremely arch beliefs. We argue and insult strangers for no reason, but you act in ways you'd never act towards other human beings. Like, you're unforgiving, and you're, like, just everything. And all this is just natural, because they would all do the same to you, so you are in the position to have to act this way yourself. And then privately, with your dwindling group of friends, that's where you act as a human being, but you're losing this war against yourself.
And that is also, I think, why Jesse James is a character for our time and why I think the Western is such a genre for our time, because the interiority, exteriority, we discussed this at length before, the inner world, outer world thing, who even is Jesse? Does he even know? I think it's interesting that his myth, or the Jesse James myth, quite an unexpected personage for this type of message, is in that sense, he is the radicalized extremist character who, when you get close to him, suspiciously human. And I think the question, what interests me, I've watched this film a million times, and Brad Pitt is so, it's almost a Richard Burton-esque in how still it is. Talking about Liz Taylor, I mean, apocryphal, but it is said that he learned that from Liz Taylor. But there's such a stillness to this performance that allows us to project, and it's this projection by all the ancillary characters and Bob Ford that makes his life impossible.
Yeah, he's utterly trapped. Like, of course, like you'd want to die yourself. If you were Jesse James, you'd be like, please, Bob, I'm going to dust the horse photo and take care of business. Like, do it.
I think in that respect, you know, since we're also comparing the performance to other things, I think it reminds me of Jean-Pierre Melville's characters, you know, the Alain Delon characters, which are also iconic before they are human. But then you do find that there's a human underneath that surface.
That's the beauty of all Melville's stuff is like, you know, like there's almost no character detail at all until you get one little bit and you go, oh, I understand the whole thing. It all makes sense.
Totally. And they're also suffocated by their own iconicity, I think, to some extent.
It's so interesting that we go to spy thrillers and like gangster type films. There's such an overlap, isn't there?
Anyway. Well, no, I think it's a great thing to bring up is I'm fascinated by, like, and this is the star quality you talk about, like, and you put it really beautifully, where it's like that we project ourselves onto these blank canvases. And it is irritating when those personalities show their own details and interrupt who we are trying to be projected onto them. Like, this is how the culture of fame is now. It's just like, it's very difficult to, when you say you find out your favorite artist is a terrible person, like, and then suddenly your own ego is blown. Like, why should I feel bad for what some person I never met did? But at the same time, so much of your made it public that your identity is so much wrapped up in this, that you feel like you must confront this.
And it's the public part. And I think that is why Jesse James and the coward Robert Ford is so interesting in this time, because Jesse James is like the poster boy for externality, right? He is nothing but his myth. Nobody remembers who he was a teenager. Nobody remembers that he lived with his mom.
Right, right, exactly.
I think for practically his whole life. I mean, nobody knows these things. Everybody knows that he was, or it's in the voiceover, so everybody should know, that he was a Confederate long after the war.
Yeah, decades. It's amazing. It's amazing.
He was a reactionary in a revolutionary sense. This is what we remember, not the kid who got shot and then was left in an attic and had the scar for the rest of his life and was an invalid because of it. This is why it's so interesting, because the externalization and the projection of Jesse James is so much more and greater than he is.
Because we want, and this is how movie stars work. Like, I mean, like people talk about this, you know, like movie stars by job description are beautiful people. Yeah, almost every one of them. Even like when the ugliest person in this movie is Sam Rockwell, and he is a very handsome man.
He is a very handsome man. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Next to Brad Pitt. I guess, but still, he is a very handsome man. And like, we want movie stars to be beautiful because we want them to be our best self. Like, you get George Clooney and, you know, whomever up there, because when George Clooney feels cool, that's me feeling cool. Ocean's 11. Like, that's what it's about, right? That's the enjoyment I get.
And we associate beauty with virtue. This is sort of very lizard brain thing.
It's an aesthetic media, exactly.
But we link that instinctively. We say if somebody's that beautiful, they cannot be wicked. But Jesse James is a terrible, terrible murdering person.
And it's that dissonance, like because what Bob wants, what Robert Ford wants, is to not be lonely anymore. And he sees Jesse is famous. And so he wants to be Jesse. But Jesse is in the way of that. As a person, like, Bob doesn't have the courage himself to do any of this. So he wants to slowly creep into that position and just become him from osmosis. Maybe I'll get some of that light. But Bob is unlikable. Like, he's a kind of skeevy,
he's a creep.
Creepy. Like, and like, even when he's just trying to be nice and funny, like, everyone's like, ugh. Meanwhile, his buddy, Dick Little, is a creep, but he's kind of a charming creep, and it really works all the time. And you're like, what has that guy got that I don't have? You know, and I think that the movie leverages this so well, where it's just like everyone around Bob, even people that are bad people, even people that are doing unlikable, unforgivable things, are more acceptable than being Bob. Nobody likes Bob. Like, he's completely outside the circle forever. And what the movie so smartly does is, by showing Jesse's collapsing external situation, like, you start to see how close that is to Bob's internal situation. And by the time Bob kills Jesse, they are the same person.
I mean, there's a reason why Bob then goes on stage to play himself, but there's basically, there's still this mirroring, absolutely.
Yes, over and over and over and over again.
And he's stuck in that. I mean, that's the thing. I think in the end, Jesse gets to be a myth.
Yes.
Bob gets to be the coward Robert Ford, and he cannot escape. I mean, I find the film immensely tragic and sad in the end, exactly because of that. Bob is a bit of a creep. And because of that, he's forever cast as the villain.
They are both killed by their own myth. Like, that's it. Like, the guy who kills Bob in the end is doing it because he read it in the papers. And he's got strong feelings about this guy he never met. And I'm like, that's something that you see in today's papers all the time.
And which also takes us back to Altman, if we wanted to go that way. There's a good reason why Altman also made a Western, because I think he's also very much attuned to the power of the Western to talk about the present day. But I think we probably have to move on to the last film. Just one last thing I want to say, which is not analysis, and it's basically just this. I think so many of my favorite Westerns are largely set in snowy landscapes. I think there's a beauty to that kind of Western. Obviously, you know, Monument Valley and all of that is beautiful and everything, but give me a snowy Western any day.
Oh, I love it. Jeremiah Johnson, any of that stuff. It's just it's just like, watch that stuff forever. And I think we do need to at least spend 30 seconds on saying, yeah, this movie got to be in the top 10 best photographed films of all time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
There are some classic shots from this that everyone's seen, but even just on the scene to scene level, it is so well constructed and so well photographed in the most subtle possible ways and creates such singular moods. Like, I'm like, the bit when Brad Pitt is riding with Garrett Dillahunt and he's going to kill Garrett Dillahunt and they're talking about the stars, like, that could be its own short film and it would still deserve an Academy Award.
It would win an Oscar. My mind keeps going back to that scene in terms of also what Westerns are about for me, in terms of the sort of doom, this overlap of somebody walking into the darkness, which also is a bridge that brings us to the next one. So maybe I should let Matt introduce.
There it is. Okay, part three.
I mean, basically, we've got the Roger Deakins link already.
That's right. It was going to be that or the Altman link because I'm wearing my Long Goodbye t-shirt. I would feel very proud of this. Yeah, there we go.
Oh, yeah. I'm not the only person who loves that movie, right?
Oh, that is no joke. If you ever want to do a podcast only on the Long Goodbye, that is one of my top five films of all time. Like, I've seen that as much as any other film. So yes, but let's move on to Texas. Yes.
As I said, we're with Roger Deakins and the film is also a 2007 film. It's the one that is least recognizably classical Western territory, you would think. But if you watch it, especially if you start watching it, you very much see the iconography. You see black hats, white hats to some extent. You see a sheriff. But I think it is very much not Henry Fonda coming to save the day or bring about civilization. So what I'm talking about, of course, is the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men, the film that Dan suggested for this podcast. So please, Dan.
Yeah, so this is another one of my very favorite films of all time. And arguably the Coen brothers' best film. Like, for me, it's in rotation with four other films as their best film.
It's the Coen brothers after all, right?
Yeah, it's the Coen brothers. What are you going to do? This movie is, before we even talk about anything that it means, I have to hold it up as it is such an incredible work of craft that if it meant nothing, it would still be one of the finest directed films I've ever seen. It makes such a meal out of every single element. It, like, everything you see is iconic. Every single sequence in the film is an icon. And they will take entire 10-minute action scenes with no music, and most of it is waiting for the next shoe to drop. There's nothing like it. It's just a perfect film.
I was thinking of you, Don, because I was rewatching this film, and I was looking at how long they shoot the bag for. The bag and the tent poles and the clothes hook. And
amazing. The journey of the bag.
And it's just so suspenseful. And it is just endlessly somebody taping up tent poles, a bag.
Yeah, that's it.
And then there's a car outside. And then there's a question of the geography of where the bag is. If it were a joke, which it's not meant to be, but if it were a joke, it would be a massive MacGuffin joke. This is the MacGuffin of all MacGuffins. It is the ultimate.
It's incredible. It's the bag of Huggies from Raising Arizona. Just right. Incredible.
I mean, I'm not sure it's not supposed to be a joke, because I do think that this is, again, you know, we've got a dark twin of another film. I think this is very much the dark twin of Fargo, mm-hmm. with its suitcase of money.
Yeah, it's pastiche. It's. I don't think it's trying to ridicule the genre, but I think it's pastiche in a way that it's... It just admires this kind of craft in filmmaking.
Oh, it absolutely savors it. Yes, absolutely. They're like, these guys are such, they're so monstrously skilled that any other filmmaker, if they were to spend as much time appreciating their own skills as the Coens do, you'd be like, you arrogant, I don't have time for this. Meanwhile, you're there with them going, give me more of this. This is incredible.
Yeah. You're totally in on it. There's... You're always part of the pastiche or the joke or the wink or the nudge. You're in on it always with them.
Yeah, because like it is because they started out essentially as like comedy filmmakers before they even made their first film, but they were helping Sam Raimi, who they've been long-term friends with. They were schooled in comedy action before they even made their first film. Their first film, Blood Simple, is on the surface very serious, but it is also an extremely funny movie. It's just an extremely dark, funny movie.
It's also a pastiche, right?
It's, yes.
Classic film noir in lurid color. Yeah.
Yeah, and they use the timing and skills required to pull off great comedy. And they push it far off, just short of being funny. So it remains anxious. Like, that's the only difference. And sometimes they keep it in, it's horrifying or whatever they're doing, but they come right up against the edge of too far. Like, if they pushed it one more note, it would be a comic scene. But they have the sensibility to hold back at the last second over and over again. And that's why this movie is also a hugely funny movie. Everything to do with sugar is funny. Like, Javier Bardem knows that he has a scary role to play, but also a very subtly funny role to play. And he is savoring it as much as he possibly can. Every note and every character movement and every beat that he offers, you can read is like, oh my God, I know what this guy's about. And I know, like, and nobody knows what's coming. This guy is just beyond the pale. And you could see it, like, you can see it when other people can't in the scene. It's just incredible.
Significantly, I think if you're talking about brinksmanship, I think the most famous moment of the film and also the most risky one is the death scene.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah.
So you see the car departing the motel with the guns going off. You see the sheriff enter into the motel and snap. You see the body and that's it.
And that's it.
That is the death scene. This is so brave as to be, it's a miracle it even works.
It's scandalous. It's scandalous. I still meet people that hate the ending of this movie.
Why don't people laugh? It's incredible. You'd think just out of pure shock.
Yeah, it's incredible.
But that's it. It's the message of the movie. It is the point of the movie. It is the whole thing in 1 second.
The Coens are geniuses in that they are the most, like, all their films are such high stakes moral gambits. Like,
oh, one of them is about Job.
Literally. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, it is such a, like, that you do not get away with anything in the universe of the Coen brothers. Like, karma doesn't come around to you. It gets you almost instantaneously. Like, if there's an infraction, it's over. Like, that's it. Like, one of my favorite examples, my wife and I always talk about this, is like in A Serious Man, which is a wonderful, wonderful movie and an incredibly funny movie. The main character is a school teacher and he's decided to accept a bribe from one of his students to give him a passing grade. He's been resisting it the whole film, and he doesn't want to do it. Like, he knows it's an imposition on his morals that is so great.
It's a transgression.
And he's so angry about it and so embittered that this has been foisted upon him. And why does he have to face this? But if he doesn't do it, everything's just going to go wrong. But he accepts the money, and all he has to do is open up the book and erase the F and write the C and close the book, right? But what happens is he takes the money, he opens up the grade book, he sees the kid's name, he sees the F, he erases the F, he sighs, he writes the C, and then he looks at it and he writes minus next to the C. The moment he writes the minus, the phone rings. It's the doctor. He has cancer. Also, his son is going to be killed by a tornado. That's what happens instantaneously. And that is slower than the judgment on Llewellyn in No Country for Old Men, which is so fast, it doesn't even happen in the blink of an eye. Like, one slight moral infraction, which is beer leads to more beer. And he thinks about it. The moment he thinks about maybe I will go in and sleep with this girl at the motel, he's already dead.
And not just that, but the sugar accident. And I think this is a great scene. I am now blanking on her name, and I'm such an admirer of her.
Kelly MacDonald.
Death catches up to her.
Oh, it's incredible.
Because that is the promise. And she says, look, the coin has no say. It is just you.
She is the great hero of the film.
She's an enormous hero. She's a moral hero of this film. Sugar is annoyed, very annoyed, because this is his world. These are his rules. It's random. And what happens? He leaves the house, he gets into a car, and bang, he gets into a car accident. A car accident that probably, we don't see it on screen, but most probably leads to his death.
Two great things. This is incredible. This is good podcasting right here. I've seen this movie a million times, and you just pointed out something I didn't notice. Both Llewellyn and his wife are killed off screen. They're killed in the edit between one scene and the next. Llewellyn is killed because of his moral infraction. Like, bam, gone, right? She is killed because she upholds her moral law. Like, she is the opposite of Llewellyn. She's like, listen, the coin don't have no say. When it cuts back to Sugar, he's crying. Like, he has tears in his eyes. She has defeated him in that moment, and he kills her anyway. That is the C minus.
Like, right. It's biblical.
Yeah. He wrote the minus, like, by killing her. He was defeated in that scene. Like, I am brave and you have no say over this. You can kill me, but that doesn't make you right.
It's all you.
Yeah, it's just
you. And you will be the one who did it.
Yeah.
It's not fate. It's not the gun. It's not the coin. You.
It's you. She puts it on him and he kills her anyway and is immediately hit by a car. Like, it's the doctor, you have cancer.
Right.
I would like to perhaps start circling this back to the beginning of the podcast. I mean, we've now been talking about No Country for Old Men and what it is, a fantastic film. There's so much to it. But I don't think we've said that much yet about why we put it in an episode on the Western. So
great, great point. I do have a bit on this. It takes place. It is a modern Western, but when it came out in 2007, it does not take place in 2007. It takes place in 1980. And I think that's very much on purpose from the book. But I think it's really emphasized in the film because you really get to visibly see that this is 1980. In American history, this is the beginning of the Reagan era. And Ronald Reagan, a movie star, is the end of the noble American project. There is no more good guy America starting in 1980.
Depending on who you ask, if you ask Dirty Harry, he'd say something completely different.
That's the thing. It's like, even with, because Dirty Harry, because I love those movies also. I think those are wonderful movies. And even I'll even go one further and say, I think the original Death Wish is a great film.
Right, exactly.
Because these movies, like many of the Dirty Harry movies are silly, but the first Dirty Harry movie is excellent. And the first Death Wish is excellent because they don't back away from their point of view at all.
Right.
They absolutely follow through the swing to the point of you being very uncomfortable with it, even if you initially agree with it.
Right. Exactly.
This is getting weird. Like, I don't know if I support this. By the end of it, you're very unsure of whether you support it. And I think that in that, they are still moral films. Like, it still leaves the question in your lap.
And that's why I mentioned them, because they are politically opposed, but the thematics of the idea of what is just has a great deal of overlap.
Yes, and you're absolutely right, because like in 1980, and I'm going to bring, here's two more modern Westerns. In 1979, I'm pretty sure. I'm going to check this out. I believe it's 79, but it may be 1980. The first Rambo movie comes out, and that is called First Blood. First Blood is a terrific film.
The only good Rambo movie.
Yes, it is a brilliant, extremely empathic, really morally curious, wonderful, good, heartfelt film that is confronting America's
trauma again. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the post-war experience, like not simply for people that went to Vietnam, but for the entirety of the American experience during the 60s and 70s. Like, this is what we have left. This is it. Then you have Rambo 2, which is not a very good movie, and is like, this is the beginning of the classic Reagan view of masculinity that has perniciously continued through to the modern day.
Right. And that's why it's worth contextualizing, because the idea of good guy America, of course, went with Nixon, right? I don't want to get into political history, but you can sort of see the timeline in which there is a doubt about your own righteousness as a culture. Are we really the good guys? And that's what these films grapple with. I mean, it's not so much Reagan the person. It's also a sort of a segue away from the moral high ground. And I think that started before Nixon, obviously, but there is a breaking point there.
Yeah, well, Nixon destroyed the trust we had in us attempting to be good. Like, because even before that, we had, Vietnam starts under Kennedy, and it starts to fall apart even under Kennedy. And we start feeling like, this is not looking good. This is bad. Why are we doing this? It's one of the most, like, when troops who were forced to go to Vietnam, forced to do terrible things, then come back and are treated badly by Americans because they did terrible things. Like, it's a horrible period, but still there's a belief that these are moral infractions against what we thought America was versus Nixon, where Nixon passed that point, you go, maybe it never was.
Right. And that culminates in this Reaganite pragmatism, right? Which is how I wanted to sort of bed this in a little bit about why the date and the timeline is significant for America particularly, because I think this is an American trauma that we're talking about here.
Well, there is a line, let's see if I can frame this correctly, because Reagan is like, obviously this is my point of view and not the point of view of this podcast, but like Reagan is the beginning of the disaster that we are still suffering. And it's because his actual point of view is just like with, Thatcher and all those folks, like is very brutal. Like is really, really relentless and unforgiving and very utilitarian in what it's trying to accomplish. Yet he frames it as, don't worry, the struggle's all worth it because we are a shining city on the hill. So he's still framing, it's like, don't worry, we still have the white hats on. Like, even though we're doing terrible stuff and we're not even treating ourselves well or the poor or anybody, we're not acting morally in the slightest, but we still have the white hats. We're in a world where there's no more mythical good guys at all, but there is very definite mythical bad guys like sugar. That scale of evil still exists. And all of the mythical good guys are old or dying or dead. Everybody else is just barely getting along and living in a crappy trailer. And maybe they stumble across some money and they're just trying to maybe we can go to, some other part of Texas. That's the landscape.
Odessa.
Yeah, Odessa, right?
Of all places. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so the, let's see if I'm correct in this. They are the famous scene with the coin, right? Like the, look at this coin and like, how much have you ever lost on a coin toss? How much have you ever lost on a coin toss? I think about this like all the time. In every single Coen Brothers movie, it's like in Fargo, there's the Mike Yanagita moment where you go, it's a great scene. Why was it there? The Mike Yanagita scene is there because in that scene, Frances McDormand is taught the lesson that people who are well-dressed might also be liars.
Right. And bad people.
Yeah. Like, just because they look like good people doesn't mean they're good people. And the very next scene, she solves the crime. Like, she's at Hardee's, she's eating, and she goes...
It's a very Coen brothers thing to do, right? They make you look.
Yes.
They make you look for the clue.
Like, what does that mean? Why was that scene there? And so, the great scene that everyone loves is the coin scene. What's the date on the coin? 1968.
That's the election year. 1968 was the election year that was all about the war.
Yes.
The Vietnam War.
Yes.
It was the election year in which Robert Kennedy was asked to run. This was the election year that, not to get too political, but I think the Democratic Party...
The 1968 National Convention riots.
...in the America of today is still traumatized by. If you can find a good book about that election year, I suggest you read it because it's like a thriller. It's incredible.
The 1968 National Convention riots, the Democratic National Convention riots, are when the good guys broke in half. That's when we died. That's it. There's a movie you can watch that is as on point about this as you can possibly find. It is a movie called Medium Cool.
Yeah.
Which was made in the Democratic National Convention riots.
Is that the Robert Forster one?
Robert Forster. Haskell Wexler calls up his buddies, all his actor buddies, and says, holy shit, there's a crazy riot going on. People are getting killed. Let's make up some characters. And in the middle of the riots, let's film things as if it's fictional. And then we'll film other stuff to lead up to it. And we'll have a movie about that that takes place in the riots. You'll never see a more perfect moment in time than that film, and that is directly related to what this movie is talking about.
And again, this is American trauma. This is about the Vietnam War. This election year was about the Vietnam War. This is about, are we still the good guys? The answer to that is no.
No. No, we blew it. We blew it. And like, this is the line that Javier Bardem has, like, he puts the coin down and he says, like, this coin has been on its way here for 22 years and now it's here and you have to call it.
And don't put it in your pocket.
Don't put it in your pocket.
Don't put it in your pocket. It's very interesting because you can see the film without any trouble, without all this. I'm trying to embed the context because American history is not a given that we all know this in, especially for European listeners. We don't get the stuff in school. I'm a weirdo and a nerd. But even without this, you can sense that there is something significant about the idea that your life depends on a bet.
It's happening right now.
You can intuit this without knowing anything about 1968.
This object, which is money, which is what we're talking about, and on the money is George Washington and an American eagle. These are the two sides of America we're talking about here, right? This is what you are calling and you have to call it. Like, this is what's going on for you watching the film. This is what's happening for Llewellyn. Llewellyn was in Vietnam. It comes up in the movie. How do we know that? Because Woody Harrelson was in Vietnam. What happens to both of these characters? They are both killed by the grand mythical villainy of Sugar, ultimately.
Right, and the Border Patrol post... He is all bloody and hurt and he wants to cross the border.
Yes.
And this man, the guard, the border guard, bullies him and says that he is, you know, the ultimate authority. And that when he heard he's in Vietnam, help the gentleman cross the border, right?
Yep. And you talk about, because we talk about, like, this is the borderlands are the nature of Westerns. The frontier is the nature of Westerns. And it is very easy to pass into Mexico one way. It is very difficult to come back.
Difficult to pass the other way.
And when Llewellyn wakes up in Mexico, I was just watching Inside Llewyn Davis, and the Mexico in Inside Llewyn Davis is Chicago. Like, this is when there's the Gate of Horn in Chicago. Like,
it's crossing over, right?
Yeah, we are crossing. This is, you're at the verge of heaven. You could get away. You could get away. But instead, you want to come back? Well, that's going to be really hard on you.
And it's interesting because, just to finish this off, because we both go like off the rails every time we
speak. Oh man, these movies,
and I love it. I'm here for it. But I, full disclosure, I thought you were going to go for True Grit.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
As your Western of choice, also because it harks back to the classic Western that it's based on. But this, I think, is far more interesting because you can also read it as a film noir with Stetson hats on, right? It's fascinating fascinating film, and it doesn't get discussed enough, I don't think.
Well, I think is that like what makes it a Western isn't like what's beautiful about it is what makes it a Western isn't the fact that it's in Texas, and it isn't the fact that it's got horses and hats and everything else that you expect. What makes it a Western is that it is an examination of who we are versus the myth of America. And what it is saying is the only reality left to that myth is villainy. The only real, because like Tommy Lee Jones talks, the first thing he talks about in the movie is you always want to compare yourselves to the old timers.
Right.
And you can almost hear the capitalization of old timers, right? And because like those are the angels, those are the great heroes of the past, right? That guarded this country. Now it's come down to me and I'm just a guy and I'm an old guy and I'm on the way out. So yeah. Like this is like, I'm not like my dad who I have a mythological dream about. I'm just a person. Llewellyn is just a person. Like, this is a landscape in which the only thing left are human beings and a great, uncontrolled, undestroyable force of pure evil called Shigur. And that is what we set in motion 22 years ago. And now we have to call it. It is about the dissolution of the American dream since the beginning of Vietnam. And the hellscape that we live in afterwards, and that it has as much of a happy ending as it does, which it doesn't. But the happy ending is that Llewellyn's wife at least gets to tell this mythological angel of death that it is also just itself. She brings it down out of the heavens and makes it a man who can be hit by a car. That's it.
I think this is probably a great point to end the conversation about those three Westerns. Before we finish this overall podcast conversation, Dan, I mean, you are obviously a gigantic film nerd, as we all are. You are also a filmmaker and you are currently working on a Western. Do you perhaps want to tell our listeners just a couple of things about it so they know what to watch out for?
I'm super excited about this. I can't tell you when it's going to be happening, but my company, my partner Chris Nichols and I have been working for a couple of years now developing a Western that, and this sounds goofy, so I'm just going to say it out loud. It's true. It came to me in a dream, but the way in which it came to me in a dream is so ludicrous that I have to tell the story of it because I dreamt that I went to the movies and on the marquee was this title for a movie called June, July. And I walked into the movie theater and I watched the movie and I woke up, to quote Tommy Lee Jones and No Country for Old Men, I woke up. And I was like, oh my God, that was really wild. And I wrote it all down. I went back to sleep. And normally, and anyone who has ever written anything will know this, when you wake up and you're like, oh, I wrote down my awesome dream. Let's read it. And you read it and it's complete nonsense. What I read was the movie we are still attempting to make right now. And it is a Western. It is I think it deals with a lot of the themes that we were talking about here, especially in terms of like my personal obsession in Westerns is vengeance and the nature of forgiveness. And it really, really locks onto that. It is a movie about a 70-year-old woman who is estranged from her son. Her son is killed by some bad guys, and she goes on a revenge kick to kill every last person involved in it. And the journey that she goes on is, let's say the movie starts out as one kind of movie and ends up as a different kind of movie. But I think it will satisfy every kind of Western fan along the way is my goal. We've got a great script. We've been shooting. We've been using some new technologies to try to shoot elements of it so we can get the money to start the main production. We've gotten some investment on that. And you can even see some test stuff we've shot online. We're being very public about its development. We want to talk about the movie in terms of movie making because it's incredibly fun. And we've had some wonderful, tremendously talented forces come to our aid in this. And we're hoping in the next year we get it off the ground. But it is called June, July. And if you hear of it, you heard it here first.
Very good. No, thank you very much.
It's going to be amazing.
I mean, that's really exciting to just once again have you on our podcast. Film fan, filmmaker, and obviously great Western fan. So thank you very much, Dan, for being with us for this podcast. We're very much hoping to see you and hear you again very, very soon. I hear that there's a film coming up about this desert planet where you might be willing to talk to us again, right?
Oh, I'm so excited. Oh, my glory be. Yeah, no, I am so honored and happy to be here again. And I cannot wait to talk about Dune 3. I hope that I'm not still, knowing how that movie, if it works anything close to the book, if I'm still a little red-eyed and teary when I come to do that podcast, I just want to tell you now, it's going to be a good one.
It is going to be fantastic. Yeah.
So obviously also thank you very much, Julie. And as always, thank you very much to our audience for listening, for staying with us. This was the second episode of our Summer of Genre. We will be back very soon with espressos and more talk of genres and movies and everything. So thanks a lot. Have a good time. Goodbye.
Good to see you both. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.